hope you had a good break over the vacation. Today I want to start work for this term by doing some work with you on deconstruction. And as before, I'm going to be talking under particular kinds of headings. The first heading is différence. And those of you who can speak both French and English will realize that there's a deliberate kind of spelling mistake in the middle of différence. The A, it's D-I-F-F-E with an acute R, A-N-C-E instead of E-N-C-E. And I'll explain why we have it in that form. Secondly, I want to talk about traces and supplements in literature and language. And thirdly, I'll talk about being and non-being. It all sounds quite peculiar, but I hope it'll make sense as and when I get there. There's also on the board over here the name of the philosopher who's most intimately associated with deconstruction, Jacques Derrida, now dead. And two words that I'll use, I think, during the lecture, with which you may be unfamiliar, logocentrism and phonocentrism. And again, I'll explain those words as and when I get there. How's that handout doing? Has it reached the back and sides? Can, if there's some spares, can two of them go that way and the rest go that way? Okay. Preliminary word or two about deconstruction. Deconstruction begins properly in philosophy, but it has implications for every kind of cultural, intellectual and political activity. In its present formulation, it derives mostly from the work of Jacques Derrida, who worked in the tradition of continental philosophy, often thought of as a philosophy associated with three great philosophers whose names all began with the letter H: Hegel, Husserl, and Heidegger. He also was interested in Kant and in a huge assortment of European philosophers of the last couple of millennia, in fact. When criticism talks of post-structuralism in general, it tends to mean the kinds of work done since what was perceived as the failure of structuralism. And that failure, if you remember, cast your mind back to when I talked about structuralism, that failure was partly structuralism's general demise as it failed in its attempt to lay bare the fundamental structures that underpinned all human activity. But there was also a rejection of structuralism as structuralism moved to the right politically. Some of the post-structuralist thinkers with whom we're going to be dealing saw structuralism as being somehow politically tainted with a certain right-wing ideology. The two most significant post-structuralist thinkers, the two who were the most influential, were Jacques Derrida and Michel Foucault, F-O-U-C-A-U-L-T. I'll speak a little bit about Foucault in a subsequent lecture. Within post-structuralism, one key movement, I suppose you would have to call it a movement now, is the movement of this thing called deconstruction. And as its name implies, deconstruction means, among many, many other things, the taking apart of the structures that organize our thinking. The analysis, which literally means taking apart, separating out, the analysis or taking apart of the structures that organize all of our thinking. It therefore begins from a kind of structuralist principle. It begins from the principle that there are structures in the first place that organize our thinking. But it then proceeds to dismantle both the structure and the very principle of structurality itself in various ways. Let me turn to this notion of différence and work my way towards it. And I'm going to work my way towards this by reminding you of some stuff to do with Saussurean linguistics that you'll know from the work that we did on structuralism and some other stuff last term. If you remember, in Saussurean linguistics, in the linguistics of Ferdinand de Saussure, who was the key thinker in our structuralist lecture, in Saussurean linguistics, difference is the basis of all forms of language. Language is built from relational ideas. That's to say, we get the meaning of the word black not from anything intrinsic to the word black, but from the relation between the word black and the word white. There's nothing, remember, nothing dog-like. I think dogs were the examples we used. Nothing dog-like about the word dog. The word dog is no more like a dog than the word cat. But in terms of how we build a language, we build a language based upon relations between words. The corollary of this is that where there is difference, there is the possibility of a linguistic system. Wherever there is difference, there is the possibility of a basic linguistic system, or a langue, as Saussure would have thought of it. Key to this, of course, was the idea that there was no substantive meaning within any word. In other words, the meaning of a word is not present to itself. The meaning of a word does not inhere in the word itself. Meaning is derived or produced from differences. The differences between words are differences between signifiers. Language is differential. Further, the system of language is constitutively different from the system of being. If you remember, even when we worked out the relation between signifier, signified, and sign, remember the signifier was the acoustic image of the word dog, the noise you make when you say the word dog. The signified is the general concept of dogginess. The relation of these two things gives you the sign. The word dog now has packed with meaning, a sign. But remember, there was an absolute divide between that and actual dogs in the real world. In other words, there was a division, if you like, between, on the one hand, the realm of language, and on the other hand, the realm of being. These two things are constitutively different from each other. It follows from that that we could say that the sign is not identical with its referent, and the relation between signs and referents is arbitrary. But key here is that language and being are of two different orders. Bear that in mind for what's coming up now, so I can get into this difference thing. Philosophy sees writing as a kind of supplementary activity. In philosophy, as with your essays, often you will say it's the thought that counts. In other words, sometimes you'll write an essay and I'll grade it poorer than you thought it was worth. You'll come and you'll say to me, why did you get that? Why am I getting that grade? And I'll explain to you, well, you've written this and that's not quite right. The right thing is, and I'll tell you what the right thing is, and you'll say, but that's what I meant. And I say, well, how am I supposed to get what you meant? All I've got is what you've written. And you say, yeah, but the writing is kind of getting in the way of what it was I was actually thinking. I was thinking the right answer, and I've given you, in writing, something that has kind of obscured the meaning of what was in my thought. In other words, it was a pain having to write this bloody thing down. If only I had managed to kind of somehow beam across to you my thoughts without language having got in the way, then you would have given me a better grade. You would have understood that I was speaking the truth. For many of us, writing is seen as something which is kind of unimportant to the thinking. It's the thought that counts, as it were. And we say this despite the fact that writing things down are crucial to the formulation of any kind of philosophy. In other words, for many of us, there's a distinction to be made between ideas and the writing of ideas. Well, when Jacques Derrida looked at philosophical texts, what he found frequently was a discrepancy between two different orders of meaning. On the one hand, he was able to find what it was that the author ostensibly meant. It was kind of fairly clear what the author ostensibly meant. And he knew that partly because when he was reading, let's say, the work of Immanuel Kant, he knew what all the philosophers had interpreted Kant as meaning, and everybody was more or less agreed about what Kant meant. However, on the one hand, we've got that, what the author ostensibly means, and he would call that the logic of the text. The logic of the text. But secondly, there is what the language of the text is capable of meaning. It's rhetoric. The language of the text could be interpreted differently from the way in which clearly the author intended to produce her or his meaning. The rhetoric exceeds the logic of a text always. The rhetoric always exceeds the logic of a text. Why? Because, for example, rhetoric requires that we use things like metaphors, for example. And metaphors are ambiguous. They are full of possible contradictory meanings or different shades of meaning. As with metaphors, so also with every element of the written language. Derrida discovers that the rhetoric in the text that he looks at frequently undermines the logic of those texts. It's for that reason, of course, that philosophers have always devalued writing, he says. seeing writing as a threat to the purity of ideas. The ideal in philosophy would be somehow to contemplate thought directly without the intermediary of writing at all, rather like you with your essay that has got a B+ rather than an A. This is what Plato argued, and it's what almost every philosopher, up to at least Heidegger, argued. Heidegger was one of the first philosophers, Heidegger, great mid-20th century philosopher, was one of the first philosophers to take language and writing seriously. And Derrida follows Heidegger in taking language absolutely as being at the center of philosophy. And he faces up to the fact that philosophy, to be philosophy, depends upon writing, and depends upon writing even more than it depends upon speech. And this is complications. Language, which we think of as the very medium of communication, has now also become, in its written form at least, the very thing that threatens to undermine straightforward communication. You know this in a very simple way. Whenever you've tried to write a poem, you may have had something in your mind as the intention behind that poem, but when somebody reads that poem, they will read into it things that you had not intended. And then as a poet, you're kind of stuck about what you want to do. On the one hand, you want to say, that's not what I was meaning. But on the other hand, because what your reader has said looks kind of smart, you kind of think, well, actually, I wish I had meant that. So you kind of begin to say, well, yeah, that meaning's there as well. And now your text is saying two potentially contradictory things, what you meant and what the language of the text can be made to mean. So your text is enriched the more fractured it becomes. And you can think of that as being at the center of what deconstruction does. By deconstruction, by, if you like, analyzing, deconstructing the text, pulling apart its structures, essentially serves to enrich the text with all sorts of new and different meaning. According to all these linguistics, remember, we speak meaningfully in terms of binary oppositions. In fact, you perceive the world in terms of binary oppositions. I've written things here on a blackboard. If I had used black chalk, you wouldn't see it. In order to perceive the stuff here at all, that there has to be a difference between the white of the chalk and the black of the background. And that's what allows us to perceive at all. You perceive me as a human being because you're aware of the fact that there are certain things that are not me down here. This chair is not me, this desk is not me, this thing around my neck is not me. It might be choking me, but it's not me. And you're aware of the fact that there's, as it were, a boundary between the thing you call me, in this instance, and these other things. And these differences allow you to make sense of what's going on down here. If I had a ventriloquist dummy sitting at one of those chairs, and I was talking, and saying, could somebody go and get me a gottle of gear? You would think, A, he's not a very good ventriloquist, but B, where is that voice coming from? The way a ventriloquist works is to confuse you about the boundaries between voice and being. We usually make sense of these things by having clear distinctions between black and white, up and down, inside, outside. Remember all those things we did in the structuralism lecture way back when? We think the world in terms of oppositions, and these oppositions form a structure. If they form a structure, that structure can, in principle, be deconstructed or taken apart. If you take the example of black and white that I've given you, we can see that in terms of the principles of colour or the perceptions of colour, there are all sorts of other oppositions that are available to us. There is, if you like, a whole spectrum of oppositions. Here on the board, I've given you two colours, black and white, and there's an opposition between them. But if you look at some of the clothes that you're wearing, some of you are wearing things that are red. How do I know they're red? Well, I know they're red because they're slightly different from the person sitting next to you is wearing something that I'm now going to call orange. How do I know that's orange? Well, I know that's orange because it's slightly different from the red, but also different from the thing next to the orange pullover wearer, because the person next to them is wearing something that I'm now going to call yellow. How do I know that's yellow? Because it's not green. How do you know that's green? Because it's not blue. How do you know that's blue? Because it's not indigo, and so on. In other words, there's a multiplicity of oppositions I can make. Supposing you've got the colours of the spectrum in front of you, as I have in front of me here. red, orange, green, yellow, whatever it is, green, blue, indigo, violet. Okay? That's all sitting in front of me. I can perceive this as an undifferentiated mass, and it will make no sense to me. In order for it to make sense to me, I must be able to make up all sorts of oppositions, but now not just one binary opposition, a whole series of different oppositions, in which I say, I will define red not by saying that it's opposite to green, but by saying that it's different from orange, green, yellow, blue, violet, indigo, and so on. And you then say to me, well, define orange then. And I say, well, orange is different from red, green, blue, violet, indigo, and so on. That's how we make sense of the world. In other words, it's not a binary opposition, not just two colors, a whole plethora of possible oppositions. In this way, we can see that as with colors, so also with words, the business of what you're about. When you look up the meaning of the word polyphyloprogenitive, you've just been reading T.S. Eliot, and you come across polyphyloprogenitive. When you look it up in the dictionary, what do you find? Well, you don't find the meaning. You simply find a whole batch of other words. But what do those words mean? Well, you have to look them up as well. And what do you find? You find not the meaning, but a whole batch of other words. And once you're in the dictionary in that way, there is no way out. You've moved, if you like, from the realm of being, where you thought that polyphyloprogenitive was something real in the world, into the realm of language. And in the realm of language, you're endlessly deferring the moment when you will get to the final meaning of the word polyphyloprogenitive, or any word that you look up. Well, at this point, I think we can say two things. The meaning of a word is always contaminated, if you like, by the meanings of other words that surround it. In exactly the same way as red, in order to define red, I will have to give you some other colors, orange, green, for example. So the meaning of red contains within itself other colors. You could say that it carries a trace of these other colors. You could say that actually what it's made up of is partly the things that it is not. The meaning is contaminated by the containing of things that are not. Secondly, we would say that the meaning of a word can never be finalized. Now, Derrida, when he realizes this is what's happening, he says that meaning is, therefore, always different from itself and is always deferred. And he puts the two French words together, différer, différer, and gives you différence. Différence is a French word that means, on the one hand, difference, in the way that we usually mean difference, something is different from itself, and simultaneously that the meaning of a word is always deferred. You will never get to the final meaning of a word. As with a word, so also with a text. The meaning of a text is always different from itself and endlessly deferred. Okay? You will never get to the identity of a text. Let me make this more complicated than it already is. Take your hand out and turn it to the side that has a passage called The Humanization of Nothingness. It's the block of text. I'm going to show you a little bit of deconstruction at work here. This is by Vincent Descombes, Descombes. And he's worrying a little bit about how being, the being of something, the being of you, is shaped by what you would call your identity. If I say to you, what is the being of Jane Bloggs? If Jane Bloggs is sitting out there, Jane's going to say, well, it's my identity. It's me, I, me. Okay, now watch what Descombes does. He says, well, if you're thinking about identity, then the opposite of identity is difference. You're saying you're not different from yourself, you're identical with yourself. Paragraph 2 on page 38. There is identity, he writes, not only, as formal logic would have it, between identity and identity. In other words, identity is identical with identity, right? There is identity between identity and identity. But there's also identity between difference and difference. Okay, let me read it again. There is identity not only, as formal logic would have it, between identity and identity, but between difference and difference. There is a certain being in not being. Now, is there the slightest difference between, on the one hand, the identity of identity with identity, and on the other hand, the identity of difference with difference? Certainly not. For there's no more identity between identity and identity than there is between difference and difference. And there's no more difference between difference and difference than there is between identity and identity. And yet, identity and difference are clearly different types of relation. Yes, certainly. Thank God at that point. You hang on to that. So, the identity between, on the one hand, the identity of identity and identity, and on the other, the identity of difference and difference, is the very factor of difference between identity and difference. And so, too, it's false to say that the identical is always exclusively identical, since in one respect at least, the identical is identical with the different. So Jane blogs out there, you are not identical with yourself. You contain within yourself something called difference. Your identity is given to you not just through your identity with yourself, but through your difference from yourself. That's what makes you Jane. Bear that in mind for what's now about to come up. We're moving here towards a philosophy of difference. As a result of this formulation of différence and the realization that a meaning of a text is always differing and differing, there's the corollary notion of the trace. Each text contains within itself the traces of all the texts that it is not, in exactly the same way as green contains within itself a trace of all the colours that it is not, but that it could have been. So green could have been red, orange, yellow, etc., but it's not those things. But the only way in which we can think the world green, or think the colour green, is by having an awareness of the possible differences between green and all the other colours that we are aware of. As with colours, so also with texts. Every text contains within itself a trace of all the other texts that it could have been, but that it isn't. The text, we therefore say, is not present to itself. It contains within itself a trace of all the texts that are currently absent from your reading. The belief that a text is present to itself, the belief that Jane is identical with herself, is part of what Derrida called a metaphysics of presence, which tries to assure us that meaning is either present to a text or present to the voice that utters the word. Derrida calls these two things logocentrism, the belief that the meaning is centered in the logos, in the word, or phonocentrism, the belief that meaning is centered in the voice, the phono, the thing that speaks. Deconstruction is concerned to reveal the elements of difference that help to make a text identical with itself. If you turn your handout over, you will get towards an understanding of some of this stuff. Let's begin by looking at the, if you turn the thing up that way, portrait style, you'll get Jonathan Culler talking about the flight of an arrow. Consider, for example, the flight of an arrow. And here what he's trying to get at is a question of how we think of reality as being that which is present to the moment, present to itself. If reality is what is present at any given instant, the arrow produces a paradox. At any given moment, it's in a particular spot. It's always in a particular spot and never in motion. We want to insist quite justifiably that the arrow is in motion at every instant from the beginning to the end of its flight. Yet, its motion is never present at any moment of presence. In other words, arrest the flight of the arrow at any moment, and at that moment, the arrow is still. It's present to itself. The presence of motion is conceivable, it turns out, only insofar as every instant is already marked with the traces of the past, where the arrow used to be, and future, where it's going to. Motion can be present, that is to say, only if the present instant is not something given, but a product of the relations between past and future. Something can be happening at a given instant only if the instant is already divided within itself, inhabited by the non-present. In other words, the present moment, now, 25 to 1, 26 to 1, on Monday morning, the 12th of whatever it is, contains within itself the past and the future. It has no meaning within itself. In order for it to exist, it has to carry within itself 27 minutes to one as well as 24 minutes to one. In other words, it has to carry traces of the things that it is not, in exactly the same way as the arrow or the text. The poem that you are reading contains within itself the traces of things that are not present to the text, the traces of other words that could have been used, the traces of other texts that were written. So that, for example, when you are reading, let me think, when you are reading Milton's Paradise Lost, you are profoundly aware of the text that is not there, the Bible. And Paradise Lost contains within itself, as part of the meaning of Paradise Lost, a text that is not being read by you at the moment, the Bible. So you're reading the text that's in front of you, but the meaning is contained partly within another text that is not present. As with that example, so with the entire history of literature in every language. And in the extreme case, we can say that every text, even the most minor, tiny haiku, contains within itself the entirety of literature as part of its meaning. That's quite difficult to grasp, but I'm going to leave it with you as something that's difficult to grasp. Now, at this point, you will want to say, look, this is all very fancy and highfalutin and, frankly, a wee bit difficult. Yeah? A wee bit difficult to follow at times, a wee bit unusual. You're going to say to me, there is some kind of moment here where we do reach a relation between language and some particular thing in reality. Where does language come from, you're going to say? And I'm going to say, well, that's a daft question. It just comes. And you're going to say, no, there was at some moment at the birth of language a relation between a word and something in the real world. A lion, for example, is going to attack me in my prehistoric or a dinosaur is going to attack me in my prehistoric cave. At some point, I must have made some noise that might not have sounded exactly like dinosaur, but big thing coming, or something like that. And that gradually mutates into the word dinosaur. There's some relation, you're going to say, between language and reality. Look at the handout. Look at item number 2. The meaning of a word, it's plausible to claim, is what speakers mean by it. A word's meaning within the, you know, in other words, that's we've got the meaning of the word dog because we all share roughly the same meaning for the word dog, okay? As we had in previous lectures. A word's meaning within the system of a language, what we find when we look a word up in a dictionary, is a result of the meaning that speakers have given it in past acts of communication. And what is true of a word is true of language in general. The structure of a language, its system of norms and regularities, is a product of events, the result of prior speech acts. However, when we take this argument seriously and begin to look at events which are said to determine structures, in other words, you say we have language that mirrors the world, there's an event in the world which determines the structure of language that we use. There was a real dog in the world that was about to bite at my ankles, so it was quite handy that we developed the word dog and the word bite and the word stop that to make sure the dog doesn't do that, okay? Events, you say, structure language. But let's take that seriously. When we begin to do that and look at the events that are said to determine structures, we find that every event is itself already determined and made possible by prior structures. The possibility of meaning something by an utterance is already inscribed in the structure of the language. The structures themselves are always products. But however far back we try to push, even when we try to imagine the birth of language and describe an originary event that might have produced the first structure, we discover that we must assume prior organization, prior differentiation. As in the case of causality, that I'm about to look at in a moment, we find only non-originary origins. Now here's the example. If a caveman is successfully to inaugurate language by making a special grunt signify food, we must suppose that the grunt is already distinguished from other grunts and that the world has already been divided into the categories food and non-food. Acts of signification depend on differences such as the contrast between and food and non-food that, am I saying something funny? That allows food to be signified, or the contrast between signifying elements that allow a sequence to function as a signifier. In other words, it wasn't the case that the first caveman came along and went, and you said, I'll have a Big Mac and double fries. Because the makes no sense unless you've already got a system of grunts, some of which are signifying a particular type of pleasure. That kind of pleasure, for example. Or that kind of pleasure, for example. But the only way in which makes sense is because sounds different from and that's different from and so on. In other words, the makes no sense on its own unless there's a system of language already prior to this grunt in place. So when you say to me, where does language come from? It must have come from events. It must have come from the fact that I was trying to run away from the dinosaur. I say to you, no. Language, that's just not the right way to put the question. Language, in a sense, is always there because language depends upon difference. And as long as we can perceive anything at all, we must be perceiving difference. And where there is difference, there is the possibility of a language, because difference is what shapes language in the first place. Now, let's turn here to the question of causality, because Jonathan Culler has directed us towards it. And this is the stuff you've got on the extreme left-hand side. You're going to see a non-literary deconstruction at work here. And what he's about to deconstruct is the principle of causality. Causality, he says, is a basic principle of our universe. We could not live or think as we do without taking for granted that one event causes another, that causes produce effects. The principle of causality asserts the logical and temporal priority of cause to effect. In other words, the cause comes first. But, Nietzsche argues in The Fragments of the Will to Power, this concept of causal structure is not something given as such, but is rather the product of a precise tropological or rhetorical operation, a chronologische Umdrehung, or chronological reversal. Suppose one feels a pain. This causes one to look for a cause, and spying, perhaps, a pin, one posits a link and reverses the perceptual or phenomenal order, pain followed by pin, to produce a causal sequence, pin followed by pain. Okay, so you've got that. You've got a pain in your backside, and you look around and you think, actually, there's a pin sticking out of this chair. What has happened here in terms of the chronology of things is that you've got the pain first, and then you spy the pin. So pain comes before pin. But you then say the pin came first. The pin causes the pain. Okay, so there's been a reversal here. The fragment, he quotes now, the fragment of the outside world of which we become conscious comes after the effect that has been produced on us and is projected a posteriori, appropriately enough, as its cause. In the phenomenalism of the inner world, we invert the chronology of cause and effect. The basic fact of inner experience is that the cause gets imagined after the effect has occurred. Now, says Culler, the causal scheme is produced by a metonymy or metalepsis, substitution of cause for effect. It is not an indubitable foundation, but the product of a tropological operation. Let us be as explicit as possible about what this simple example implies. First, it does not lead to the conclusion that the principle of causality is illegitimate and should be scrapped. On the contrary, the deconstruction itself relies on the notion of cause. The experience of pain, it is claimed, causes us to discover the pin, and thus causes the production of a cause. To deconstruct causality, one must operate with the notion of cause and apply it to causation itself. The deconstruction appeals to no higher logical principle or superior reason, but uses the very principle that it deconstructs. The concept of causation is not an error that philosophy could or should have avoided, but is indispensable to the argument of deconstruction as to other arguments. Now, in there, what you're seeing is a deconstruction where the meaning of pain and pin get changed because their priorities get changed. What I want to do now in the final section of this lecture is to try to show you how deconstruction would work in a kind of literary example. Hang on a second, this thing is choking me. Hence the that you heard a moment or two ago. This is quite painful. Okay. Derrida was always at pains to say that deconstruction is not something that can be methodologically applied. The deconstruction that you will effect in any particular text is determined by the text itself. In other words, there's no recipe for doing a deconstruction. That said, there are certain things that tend typically to happen. And there are basic steps that you would go through in the making of a deconstruction. First of all, I'll go through the steps first, and then I'll try to give you some examples. Okay, so the steps. First of all, you notice a binary opposition that seems to be shaping a particular meaning for something. In that binary opposition, you've got two poles that are opposed to each other. And in every such binary opposition, one of the poles, for whatever reason, will propose itself as being central or normative, and the other will be a derivation from the norm or somehow not central, peripheral, secondary, derivative, not as important. In other words, there's a hierarchy in the opposition you've got. So step one, you notice the opposition. Step two, you notice the hierarchy. Step three in any deconstruction would be that you construct an argument using the terms of the hierarchy in order to reverse the polarity and to reverse the hierarchy, as with the causality thing. And step four, you reinstate the binary opposition, but with the terms now meaning something different. Now, that's the abstract version of this. Let's put it into practice. Let's take an opposition that shapes our world, a gender opposition, male, female. You say to me, define male. And as with all the colors, when you ask me to define red, what I need to do is to define male, not in its own terms, because it can't be defined in its own terms. It's not present to itself. I need something that is opposed to male in order to define myself as male. So I'm having a great deal of difficulty defining myself as male until a woman comes in, and the woman walks across here and I say, aha, now look, we take all our clothes off, and now look, there's a difference here. I've got something that she hasn't got. So male, I can say to you, is defined by the presence of the phallus. You think, thank God for that. Well done. So, I've got an opposition now. And that opposition establishes a hierarchy between presence and absence, the presence of the phallus, the absence of the phallus. Okay? In that opposition, I've said, woman is defined by absence. And male, me, I'm defined by presence. So I've got my binary opposition, male, female. I've now got my hierarchy, presence against absence. Presence, clearly, is more present. It has more being than absence does. So I say, I'm the norm, and she is the derivation of the norm. She would be fully present to herself as a human being if and only if she had this extra wee bit called the extra big bit called the phallus. Excuse my modesty. Okay, so you've got the opposition, presence against absence, and you've got a hierarchy that says presence is more important or more normal than absence. So male is more normal than female, you say. Okay? Now, here's the clever bit. You're going to deconstruct this opposition for me, and you're going to use the very terms that I've used, presence and absence. And what you're going to say is, fair enough, you've defined woman as absence. But let's go back to stage one, when you were trying to define yourself before that woman walked in. At that moment, the thing you needed to define yourself as male was something you didn't have. The woman that you needed was absent from you. If she is defined by absence, then you are defined by absence to the second power. Because she might lack the phallus, and while you've got the phallus, nonetheless, you lack the thing that lacks the phallus that you needed in order to define yourself as male in the first place. So while she's only lacking one thing, you're lacking two. And I think, clever. And I think at that moment, new man. Suddenly, I'm now not at the center of things as male, but I've been put onto the margin of things. And we have reversed the polarities of the hierarchy in such a way as to show that woman is, as it were, more normal than man, as you all know, because you're all new men or feminists. Now, at that moment, we don't abandon the opposition. We reinstate the terms of the binary opposition. We've still got an opposition male and female, but we now think them differently. It used to be the case that we thought of men as being normal and women being not quite full men. Now, we don't think that. And we don't think that because of the deconstruction. The deconstruction has changed the meaning of the terms male and female by changing the way in which we think of the opposition between male and female. Okay, now that example, I'm at pains to point out to you now that that example is, of course, purely ideological. At no point do I think that women lack anything. But one of the reasons why I think that way is because of deconstruction. Deconstruction has changed the way that people, not just I, people, including you, think about gender relations. And what it has done is to effect a change in the real world by changing how people think and use language. As with that linguistic example, so also with a text. For example, you're reading Wuthering Heights. And when you're reading Wuthering Heights, there's many, many ways in which you can make oppositions here in that text to make sense. The way you make sense of Wuthering Heights is, for example, to have an opposition between Wuthering Heights, up in the moor, and Thrushcross Grange, down in the valley. That'd be one opposition, up and down, one house against another house. Another opposition might be the opposition of nature and culture, might be the opposition of Ireland and England. Remember where Heathcliff comes from? It looks as if he's Irish. So you might have an opposition between the foreigner and the domestic. There's all sorts of ways in which you can make meanings of that text. But whatever you do, if you're going to do a deconstruction, you will take one of the oppositions that is structuring that text for you, and you will work on it. Let's take the opposition of nature and culture, for example. And let's take the moment in the text where we begin to work out what nature and culture might mean. Mr. Lockwood is making his way up to Wuthering Heights from the safety of Thrushcross Grange. Up on the moor, the weather starts closing in, and you think that's the presence of nature. It's threatening. It threatens Lockwood's very life. He's terrified. He's got to get into shelter fast because he might die out on the moors. The weather's that bad. You know what it's like up there. The weather's terrible. And luckily, there's a house. So he knocks on the door, the house of Wuthering Heights, he knocks on the door, and Heathcliff opens and says, come in. And Lockwood goes into the house, and you think, great, this is the realm of culture. It's the opposite of nature. It's calm, it's quiet, it's a realm of safety. Within about 10 minutes in the presence of Heathcliff, Mr. Lockwood is trying desperately to get the hell back out of the house, because if it was dangerous outside, then by God it's dangerous inside. Because Heathcliff is so unpredictable, terrifying, terroristic even, and you're beginning to think, actually, I felt safer, not in the realm of culture, but in the realm of nature. Let me get back out there. You still have an opposition between nature and culture, but what you thought of as the meaning of nature is now different from what you did think of as the meaning of nature differs from what you now think of as the meaning of nature, and likewise, what you thought of as culture, the realm of the domestic space, the realm of the family life, is different from what you now think of culture. You now think of culture as something which is terrifying, something which is life-threatening, something which, as that text points out, can endanger your life. Books endanger you as every bit as much as they edify you. It's not that you've abandoned the relation or the opposition between nature and culture, it's just that you're thinking the terms differently. So that when you come out of having read Wuthering Heights in this particular way, you come out thinking the notion of the relation between nature and culture differently from the way in which you began when you opened the text in the first place. Your deconstruction has taken a hierarchy between nature, which is natural, and culture, which is ideologically formed, and reversed it. So that nature, you begin to think of as something which is ideologically formed, it's a matter of a mental construct, and culture, you begin to realize, is this brute force that we call Heathcliff. You reinstate the terms of your binary opposition, but they now mean something different. In other words, the meaning is different from what it was before. So let me go back to the abstract formulation here and see if it makes more sense to you now. When you're reading a text, you pick up on any one of the many oppositions that helps you to structure that text as a meaningful event. When you notice the opposition, you establish also what the hierarchy is of the opposition. Which of the poles proposes itself, for whatever reason, as normative? Which of the poles proposes itself as secondary, a derivation of the norm, or a deviation from the norm? Third step, construct an argument that reverses the hierarchy of that opposition. And fourth step, reinstate the terms of the binary opposition, male, female, up, down, nature, culture, love, hate, but now meaning something very different from what they used to mean before. As with the gendered example, we had men and women, and now we have new men and feminists, for example. Once you've done that, you realize that that's not the end of the story, because you've now got a new binary opposition. It's the one that you've reinstated, but with different meanings for the terms. And that opposition is in turn ripe for deconstruction in due course. So deconstruction leaves you endlessly deferring a final meaning and realizing that the final meaning is always going to be different from itself. Deconstruction, therefore, requires endless reading and rereading and re-arguing. It requires that you constantly keep the text alive by the production of new meaning, by the production of more meaning. Deconstruction, unlike virtually every other kind of criticism, refuses to have the last word about a text. On the contrary, what it's trying to do is to open up the text as if for the first time, and to allow you to see it as if for the first time. Because, as with the example of male and female, you're seeing things now for the first time. You're seeing that male is defined by the absence of an absence and not by presence, for example. Okay, next week I'm going to take some of this forward into the question of reader response criticism. So next week, reader response criticism, Wolfgang Iser, Hans-Robert Jauss, and others. Thanks for your attention.